Today on Wings, Mindy Ran shares excerpts from her 2024 interview with Max Dashut, creator, curator, and director of the unique and astonishingly comprehensive Suppressed Histories Archives.
When I began doing slideshows back in 73, 74, women would come up and say over and over again, "Why don't we know about this?"
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Max Dashut was born in 1950, grew up in the U.S. state of Illinois, won a scholarship to Harvard University, and started there in 1968, a year of intense social and political revolution. Appalled by the sexism of the institution, Dashut says she quit school but kept her library card. After saving some money by working at an agriculture factory, she came back to Cambridge and started her own research. By 1970, she had founded what would become the Suppressed Histories Archives, where she collects, organizes, presents, and teaches the evidence of women's roles, culture, and experiences in history and prehistory. It's been described as a hybrid of academic research and popular education. Here's Mindy Ran.
2024 is the 54th year of the Suppressed Histories Archives, the brainchild and life's work of renowned feminist historian Max Dashut. The archives consist of over 50,000 interdisciplinary slides, documents, and images. They cover global women's history, indigenous orature, and anti-colonial, anti-patriarchal narratives. I asked Dashut how this lifetime's work began.
When I moved back to Cambridge, I went home and worked in my agricultural factory for a couple months to get some money back together after I left Harvard. And at that time, I did not think I was founding an archive. I just knew that in order to uncover women's history, I had to have evidence, because it was literally a joke at that time. So I needed to pile up documentation for any statement I wanted to make. I knew it would be challenged. And so I had to have, you know, either written materials, and then later on, a lot of it is visual, especially all pre-literate societies or non-literate societies. You know, you're looking at iconography as a main line of evidence. And so women's history is necessarily very interdisciplinary. And of course, this is all pre-digital, pre-internet. So we're looking at card catalogs, you know, and there's a whole bias to the way that the information was organized and constructed. Card catalog, women, housewife, fashion, you know, this kind of stuff, motherhood, not to diss motherhood, but it was just, you know, there were these conceptual ghettos that women were locked into. So it took a long time for me to track down where the evidence could be found even. And there was a whole issue about the way knowledge is organized in Western civ, in the libraries, because Indigenous history was not found in history sections, or very rarely, but it would be found in ethnography under the anthropology header. And, you know, this is where the orature, if it was written about at all, that's where you would find it. So there were all these biases. For example, one idea I began with is that it would be more likely to find egalitarian social structures in indigenous societies than in imperial ones. I mean, that's just, you know, you're dealing with class-ranked societies. We already know that the empires are patriarchal. We could look at European or Chinese or, you know, all the different colonial systems of domination that are in history, and they're all patriarchal. But what about the other end? And you can't assume either that indigenous means that it's not patriarchal. You just have to really look in there and find out what's there. For example, you know, in a matrilocal society, women are at the center. They're structurally at the center. And this gives supports to women as the child bearers to be near their kin, near their support systems. It means you don't have homeless children. And so there are consequences. It's not neutral.
Would you say these archives are a reflection of the way your brain works?
Well, maybe to some degree, but you know, I was really just canvassing the libraries and looking. I felt like I had to really understand everything. I mean, initially I was looking for matriarchies because I had heard this anthropologist say, well, you know, it doesn't matter if there's matrilineal societies because all societies are male dominated. And I didn't know what was out there. I had to learn a lot. And so I'm not only looking at the indigenous cultures, but I'm also trying to see where are the regions in the world that are not dominated by imperial states, by standing armies, by resource extraction from others, you know, enslavement and so forth. And, you know, hoping that egalitarianism would also be reflected in sex, which, you know, for anthropology, a lot of time when they talk about egalitarian society, sex does not enter into it. This has historically been true. It may have changed to some degree, but, you know, it's just kind of left off the boards. What happens to women so often is disregarded. So the central organizing principle of the archives was to find out where are the women and what's happening to them? What's their standing? What's their situation? How much liberty do they have? Choice, self-determination. So there's a lot of questions on the table. And, you know, the lines of evidence too, because we have, okay, there's the written history, and that's very limited, being from male elites primarily, shaping most of what we have for ancient times. You know, the inscriptions in stone, that's not something that has to do with peasant women, unless it's their enslavement. But we have to look at the deep history now. We're getting more and more. First, it was ethnolinguistics and the study of language families, which showed us movements of peoples and interrelations between peoples. Now we have the genome research, which is showing us also very deep levels of human history before anything is recorded. We have archaeology, and so we can look at ancient temples or village sites and see how things are organized. Sometimes there's long houses and there's a more collective organization. There is also indigenous orature, very important, because those are primary sources. It's very different, you know, in the universities, a primary source used to be, well, you know, this was written by, you know, the Jesuit relations were written in Eastern Canada by a French priest. And so that's a primary source because it's an original source. But he's writing, and you know, that particular source is really valuable in talking about the Haudenosaunee, the six nations of the Iroquois, five nations at that time, because he's saying nothing is more real than the superiority of the women. I don't think that would be an Iroquoian point of view. That was a French patriarchal point of view, because it isn't really a dominance-based society, especially as the sexes are concerned. But that was his perception of a culture that was so profoundly different than his own, which was based on superiors and inferiors. So you kind of have to read through those so-called primary sources. But the real primary sources are the oral keepings, as they call them. You know, the Great Law of Peace, for example, encoding matrilineage, and the mothers, they are the guardians of the soil. So this is an oral code of law that was very developed before the English and French colonists came in. Over the 54 years since I've been doing this, a lot has happened, because more and more we are seeing books by indigenous people about their own traditions, and indigenous women especially, which is very often the very hardest thing to find. It's a long known critique of anthropological method, is that they made assumptions based on only what the men told them, and they didn't have any input from the women or any idea of authority that women might have in those cultures.
Do you feel that this need to be so precise came up out of your experience in Harvard?
Look, I rebelled against that, actually, and I lost some important documentations, because there was a period of time I just thought it's all patriarchal, it's all, you know, domination-based, and so who cares, you know, what the source was. And then I was disabused of that by indigenous people who were saying, well, what's your source for that? So, you know, it's like, okay, even if the source is very problematic, part of the thing is we have to do a critique. But I'd say more that my desire has been to undo not only the patriarchal scripts, but also the colonial scripts. And without a critique of the sources we're using from that standpoint, garbage in, garbage out, basically, you have to be able to be aware of the biases in order to get a true picture, or as close to one as we can manage.
This really is a life's work.
What I'm doing is provisional. Because of the suspicion I have around sources, that's part of it. There are huge gaps that we may never be able to fill about whole areas of the planet. But what information comes in, often I find like there'll be part of a juicy quote, and I didn't really know until years later that the secondary source I got that quote from left out some of the most significant information. And then, you know, maybe 20, 30 years later, I'd find the rest of the quote, and it's like, oh, there's more. And so there's this process of deeming unimportant or being threatened by causing the sources you're working with to withhold information. They just didn't see it as significant because it wasn't about kings and chiefs and rulers, generals. And it was just, you know, the old village woman who was in charge of the ceremony, whatever it may be. And I have to modify my information as corrections come in.
On Wings, you're listening to Max Dashew, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, speaking to Mindy Ran. A great deal of Dashew's work has been collecting and contextualizing visual imagery, creating many, many slideshows and videos for public presentations and courses.
I'm trying to gather together all of the cultural testimony, and that includes written, archaeological, iconographic, so there's all the ancient female figurines or perhaps wooden statues, and looking at them also as reflections about something about how the society sees women. Very often ancestral women come into this, not only goddesses, as many of us assumed, but you know, when you look at indigenous cultures and you see the importance of ancestors, then the grandmothers becomes one line of interpretation for those ancient figurines, going all the way back to the Paleolithic. So in the sexist standard anthropological interpretation, then it would be, well, you know, these are sex objects, you know, from the standpoint of the male gaze. And then, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, these are mature women. They're large women, you know, long hanging breasts, folds of fat. They are very different from what our society thinks about as sex objects. But, you know, that just even to jump to that as an interpretation leaves out so many other realities. So what patterns emerge when you look at this in a global way? Because, you know, most of us are more exposed to the European figurines, but then there are those in the Nile Valley. There are some which have turned up in the Sahara, which is a very, very ancient reservoir of culture that has got not nearly enough attention to it historically. Some amazing rock paintings that are quite ancient. Like we're talking in a range of 8,000 to 4,000 BCE for some of these Algerian and Libyan rock paintings. That's cultural testimony. You know, some of it's daily life and other times it's ceremony. And you can't necessarily tell, like there's a famous, the Lady of Aurangzeb in the Tassili Nazir. This running woman, but she's dressed in ceremonial regalia and she has these fringes, long streamers bound around her arms and her lower legs. And her body is stippled with these dotted patterns. You know, they could be scarification, they could be tattoos, they could be body paint, but they seem to represent some kind of idea of numinous energy inherent in her. And then on her head is this long crescent that looks like animal horns. Some people see it as a lunar crescent. And so there's many interpretations of this image, and we can't tell, is this meant to be a medicine woman in ceremony? Is this a goddess? Is this an ancestral woman for a particular clan? And we're never going to know. That's just the nature of this archaeological beast, is that there's such a long break in time distance from that period. Who knows who the descendants of those people are that made that painting? So, you know, that's often, there's this interpretative break where we just can't say without other contextual information. Maybe some archaeological sites do show a female figurine occurring within a shrine. Context is a lot, but unfortunately, my sources, as I'm reading a lot of these archaeological excavation reports back in the 70s, you'd be lucky to find a photo. It wouldn't necessarily even have a site name on it because it was not deemed important. And, you know, all these female figurines, maybe they are sex symbols, maybe they are fertility idols, which continues to be a really stereotypical framing that is a favorite among archaeologists even now after all these years. Or maybe they are concubines or dancing girls. There's just all these insulting interpretations. And especially the older sources don't give the importance to the female iconography to tell you what was the fine context.
On Wings, Max Dashew, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, is speaking to Wings reporter Mindy Rand.
What I'm curious about is the suppressed histories. Mm-hmm. How do you find and what do you define as suppressed histories? I mean, if they've been suppressed or destroyed, how do you piece them back together?
Right. I mean, suppressed can take a lot of forms. So you do have a lot of goddess statues from Western Asia, the Mediterranean, different parts of the world, whose faces have been smashed. You know, broken noses, you know, deliberate defacement, literal defacement of goddesses, of pagan icons. And you certainly see under Christian and Islamic regimes and earlier the Judaic regime, a persecution of these older forms of culture by the new dominant religion. So that's a direct suppression. And that would also include book burnings, destruction of previous dynasties sometimes also takes that form. If you go through Egypt, you'll see a lot of the reliefs have been attacked. Some of them look like they threw chains at them or chiseled out these irregular patterns, especially directed to the face. So that's a direct suppression, especially of women. It's not to say there are no male gods that have never been defaced. Goddesses are a particular target, especially in these Abrahamic attacks on systems that were polytheistic and who had female deities, great mothers or whatever. And so, for example, the veneration of Isis, you had the archbishops of Cairo and Alexandria going around and searching out the secret shrines that people had built behind a wall so that they could continue their devotions, because simply because the state decreed Christianity as the only legal religion didn't mean people all of a sudden just went, yeah, okay, now we're Christian. You know, they continued. And there's much, much evidence of that in various countries of the extreme conservationism, not conservatism, but the desire to keep beloved cultural forms. I think that my concept of suppression also extends to this kind of blinkered view, this attempt to sort of to either omit deliberately or through disregard, through discounting. You have gatekeeping at multiple levels in the publishers, in you know what the books get titled, what gets edited out from the books, and then also what books fall out of publication. One way you can see this in the Greek world is that the Sappho is one of that famous lesbian poet. Her work survived because it was beloved even by men, but we don't have her complete works the way we do with Apollodorus or others, so that the male bibliophiles and the collectors, you know, when they were fleeing maybe from an invasion or, you know, a fire, whatever, what books did they take with them? Or what books did they acquire in the first place? So there's a constant attrition, like particles sifting down to the floor of the ocean. The works of female authors who did exist in lesser numbers always, but they were there, get lost. They get swept away. They get forgotten. And so there's that kind of suppression as well. It isn't necessarily conscious of we want to get rid of this, but this devaluing and failure to preserve that happens.
Do the archives include, you've been talking a lot about ancient histories, are they also brought through to today?
Oh, yes. I see patriarchy as a historical process, And there's layers and layers and accretions that build up. There's a very wide range of patrilineal societies, including some of the indigenous cultures, that they weren't as bad as the Romans. They were patrilineal. You know, you have to sort of make distinctions between the actual standing of women and the degree of self-determination they had. So that varies a lot, even inside patriarchal or patrilineal systems.
I was caught by a comment about the suppressed histories, which said that you are including narratives of women who were central to events, but often left out of mainstream accounts. How do you find those back?
Yeah, that's the hard part. You know, you have to read a lot. And I just have my antenna always poised. So here's an example. The first international spectrum show I created was Women in Power. Just looking at female spheres of power across the world, including in patriarchal societies. Because you do find cultures where women are dominated within the family structure, but they may still be very powerful, like in the marketplace, or they may, especially spiritual spheres of power, priestesses and female oracles and healers and medicine women are something that you will see happening. Like, for example, in medieval Europe, deeply patriarchal society, and yet there were certain women who were respected as healers and herbalists. So you find these persistences happening. But anyway, within that show, I noticed that the women who were in revolutionary movements, indigenous resistance against colonization, there was a pattern there of them being spiritual leaders of some kind. And that these women, because of that spiritual prestige that they had, wound up leading these revolts against colonization. So I started a new presentation on that. At first, I think I had like 38 slides. That was the starting point. But now I have too many for a 90-minute presentation. It's a definite pattern. And so you have women like Wananhucha. She was descended from Tanzanians who had been taken out in the Swahili slave trade and trafficked up to Somalia. So she led an exodus, basically. Very much as Harriet Tubman did, for that matter. And she was also a visionary, a dreamer. So, but Wananhucha was a Nganga, which is a Bantu name for the medicine people and the diviners. And there's just countless, countless instances of that. The heritages we have, there's just all kinds of riches. There are the women drummers in Eritrea and various parts of Africa. There are the medicine women who are healers, which who are still going along in spite of all of this. There are ceremonial leadership of women in the Candomblé religion, this Afro-Brazilian religion, and so many other traditions. Women are recouping some of our losses. That's happening as well. Big movements inside of Native North America to revalue the women and, you know, the work that the women do and the leadership of women. And so these are all developments that are going on, you know, this recovery, or as they're calling it, rematriation. So here in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Ohlone Nation, women elders founded a land trust to attempt to reestablish a land base from all of the territory that was stolen from them during the genocidal gold rush. These are all things that are happening. And from my standpoint, just even the recovery of all this cultural heritage, I feel like, yes, women are demoralized. We're intended to be demoralized by all this backlash. They want us intimidated. But when you look at this whole swath of cultural achievements and the treasures in the archaeology or even in the photographic record, things that are buried away and hidden, but nevertheless, there they are. You know, these women who discovered hydrogen or whatever. I think of the Suppressed Histories Archives as bringing medicine to women for our spirits, because we do get so beat down and so discouraged. And you look around and you see all of this. I can't use that word on the air. You know, we do have these heritages and we have been powerful and we are still powerful. And there are things being done which are not getting publicity which are really, really crucial by women or by anybody who supports egalitarian and cooperative culture. You know, we have to turn away from the aggression and towards the cooperative and away from the authoritarian, which has really become increasingly dominant in U.S. politics.
I ask you if what you did is social archaeology.
We also say, you know, it's historical recovery work. I mean, there's a lot of ways we could describe it, but we need this knowledge and we need the images. That's why I teach with images, because to see it is different. You feel it when you see the picture of the Chilean machi, the medicine woman, beating on her cultrón and leading ceremony for a whole community of people in southern Chile. It's just inspiring to see this. And when I began doing slideshows back in 73, 74, women would come up and say over and over again, why don't we know about this? How come we never see any of this? It was not shown to us. It was withheld. And I'm not saying there's a conspiracy. I just think it's more of a tendency that it was either dismissed at one end or it was deliberately omitted because it was subversive to the patriarchal order. And so we recover it. We get it back. And it really helps that we have our digital platforms to do that with, you know, and we can find the Choctaw herbalists who are still among us and the granny healers in Appalachia and all of these things. I've been working on the goddess religion. There was this big goddess resurgence in Vietnam after the American War. And people were going back to very old matricultural roots and very much integrating it with their modern lives. So it can be quite surprising sometimes to see what bubbles up once the chains are taken off.
And these archives are open access.
Well, the archives, the physical archives is not. My whole project is to get as much of it out in digital form as I can. So currently there's the website. We have to overhaul the website. I have migrated 14 years worth of daily posts on Facebook, photo essays that I put up. They're on this site, but I need to create navigation pages so people can access them. So that's the next big step, is to get more available and get it tagged by content so people can search. And if they're looking for African priestesses, they can find that. If they're looking for the archaeology of East Asia, they can find that. Birth, women warriors, all these different categories.
That was Max Dashew on the Suppressed Histories Archives. This is Mindy Ran in Amsterdam for Wings.
To find images and information from Max Dashew's 54 years of work on the Suppressed Histories Archives, visit the website suppressedhistories.net. That's suppressedhistories.net. To connect with Wings, visit the website wings.org or check facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events with diverse topics and speakers can be watched at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.